Some of the views expressed on the Mormon Channel are solely for the education and inspiration of our audience and may not represent the official position of the Church.
We welcome you again to our program, Past Impressions, on the Mormon Channel of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. I'm Brent Topp, the chair of the Department of Church History and Doctrine at Brigham Young University, and I'm honored to be your host today. We are so pleased to have on Past Impressions some wonderful guests and scholars. Today, our guests are Brother Michael Landon, archivist for the Church History Department of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, who has been with the Church History Department for 23 years. And we're also pleased to have Mel Bayshore, curator of the associated with the historic sites of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, also of the Church History Department here in Salt Lake City. And both Mel and Mike are great scholars and know the trail and all of the pioneer stories so well. And Mel has been with the church for 36 years. And so we are so honored to have both you, Mike, and you, Mel, with us today on Past Impressions. Today we're going to pick up with our story of in our last episodes we talked about that Vanguard party that is most associated with the 24th of July 1847, but that in reality was just the beginning of the story of many more companies. And so Mike, why don't you tell us of some of those 47, 48, and then in future episodes we're going to talk about even more companies that go for many years after 1847.
I'd be delighted to. Actually, one of the interesting companies for that 47 year would be the Mormon Battalion, actually. They were discharged in Los Angeles in July. And after discharge, many of them traveled north from the L.A. Basin to the Sacramento Valley area, Sutter's Fort. Mm-hmm. And from there, a very large group began ascending the Sierra Nevada to return to their families. They had information that the Saints were going to be settling in the Salt Lake Valley. They knew generally that idea, but they didn't know whether they were going to find their families there or not. They didn't know whether the families mm-hmm. were going to be there or still back in Iowa. Mm-hmm. And so in 47, when they began ascending the Sierra, they got part way and James Brown, they met him, and he had correspondence from Brigham Young in a letter to Jefferson Hunt, who was one of the leaders of the battalion, telling him not to go on to the valley if they could go back to the Sacramento Valley and stay there, because they didn't know they were going to be able to sustain them. Mm-hmm. It was the circumstances were pretty difficult in the valley. So about half the company, the battalion company, turned around and went back to California. Hmm. Another group continued into the valley that included Jefferson Hunt, and about 30 of those individuals did not find their families when they got to the valley. Hmm. Their families were still back on the Missouri. And so what do you do? This is October is when they arrived, and they want to be with their families. Well, winter's coming on. They've never made this trek back to the Missouri. But I think the experience that they had just passed through in the battalion had given them a sense that sort of empowerment. Mm-hmm. This is no big deal. We can do it. Mm-hmm. And so they set out eastbound without really knowing where they were going. And in December, they finally started closing in on the Missouri, the Winter Quarters Council Bluffs area. And they were on the Elkhorn at one point, and William Hyde described in his journal that they were absolutely out of provisions. And they huddled together in council. He describes it as a council. What are we going to do? And some of them thought that they ought to just go into winter camp and just stay where they're at. And his reply was, well, I've just marched 5,000 miles, and if I'm – I don't know how close, but I know I'm close. I don't want to stop. Mm-hmm. And so he offers his own mule as a free will offering if the Lord does not provide some kind of sustenance for the men in the meantime. And so they had a prayer, and he was ready to give up his mule, and then wild turkey flocks came through. Mm. And there were 16 men in his group, and they bagged four turkeys, one for each four guys.
Yeah.
And it sustained them, and they went on. They were about – I think they were within 35 miles. They finally stumbled into Winnacortis Council Bluffs area and found their families.
You know, that is an inspiring story of not only what they had been through, but how they desperately wanted to be reunited with their families. And I've that wonderful story of the turkeys. I mean, most Latter-day Saints are familiar with
the quail.
The quail, but
quail sounds better than turkey, yeah. I think.
Mel, many of those have to head back to the Salt Lake Valley, and then we get into the 1848 companies. Why don't you share with us the significance of some of those companies?
There were still, I'll get into that, but there are still people left in California in the battalion, and they are there in 1848 at the time of the gold discovery.
Mm-hmm.
And there's
involved
a man
in it.
Involved in it.
Yeah.
Some of involved in finding the gold. Mm-hmm. So we have a great legacy in terms of that. That tremendous part of California history, world history, really, in the gold rush. But some of those men that were in the battalion had not come ahead in 47. They'd stayed back in California, some working in the San Francisco area, some in the Sacramento area for Sutter. One of those who stayed back in that last year was Robert Pixton. And he'd stopped there and got some gold in May. And then in June, he decided to that he missed his family, he missed his wife, and he decided to start back and journey to see her. And so he hadn't seen his wife in over 2 years, and so he started back with this group of returning battalion men, who then reached Salt Lake one week before. Or after his wife did. His wife had been there for a week, and she had come from winter quarters. And in 1848, that was a big year. Brigham Young had gone back with some of those early 47 pioneers, and some of those battalion vets had been a part of that group who'd gone back to winter quarters to get their families. And so we have a large group of people who want to go to where the church has established Zion in the mountains. And so we have three companies, three very large companies, one headed by Brigham Young, another by Willard Richards, and another by Heber C. Kimball. These were, when they left winter quarters, Brigham Young's company had over 1,200 people in it. Huge. And Brigham asked them
almost 10 times more than the Vanguard.
It was almost unwieldy. There were almost 400 wagons. You had 74 horses, 19 mules, almost 1,300 oxen.
Thinking of all the grazing,
the grazing that you have to do, especially going. At a time of year, well, they did leave at a good time of year because the grass would have gotten high enough that their cattle and things could have fed well on it. But you had over 700 cows, 411 sheep, 141 pigs. How are you gonna herd pigs? They're just gonna scatter here from here to there. 605 chickens. They got their morning eggs. 37 cats. We often don't think about taking pets along, but they also had 82 dogs, 10 geese, 2 beehives. Which wagon got to carry the beehive? And somebody even had a crow with them. We often don't think about those things, but it was a traveling community, and they had to bring everything with them that they would need in the valley or on the way.
And so And was that just Brigham's, or was that all three of the companies?
No, that was solely Brigham's.
Would the other companies be pretty much the same?
Pretty much the same makeup. Heber C. Kimball's company had almost 700 people in it, and then Willard Richards had over 500 in his. So these are large companies. Brigham's company, when they got past Grand Island at that point, they broke up in smaller segments. Mm-hmm. But still, as they left winter quarters, they were going four abreast with their wagons. Mm-hmm. This was like a freeway mm-hmm. at rush hour.
That's amazing. You know, and we've talked about the Vanguard company. They're blazing the trail, if you will, and this is much different. I like the analogy of a freeway, and they're all heading there. What other things do you find unique about the 1848 companies different than that Vanguard company? What makes 1848 so unique in the annals of the pioneer treks?
I think it's the size of the companies, really, that makes it unique. In fact, there's at one point when the company was still very large in Brigham's company, it took them a full 2 hours to create the corral at the end of the day, just to form up the wagons. And they would do it in such a manner, it kind of looked like a squashed football, the way they would do it. They would line up each wagon so that to interlock the wheels, the front wheel of one wagon would interlock with the hind wheel of its neighboring wagon. And in that way, they would create on either side kind of a squashed football mm-hmm. with an opening on either end so that they could have access in and out with their horses and then also be able to have their cattle within inside that corral and during the night.
Mm. Mike, what do you see as the unique contribution of the 1848 companies?
Well, actually, for me, the real interesting aspect of 48 is you've got a whole population in California. Mm. You have at least three companies of Mormon battalion vets as well as people who had gone around Cape Horn on the ship
Sam
Brooklyn,
Brannan.
Right,
mm-hmm.
who are winning their way over the Sierra Nevada to the valley. And these are individuals who were in on the ground floor of the gold rush. Mm. It's written retrospectively, but James S. Brown said that we could have made our fortunes, but we knew where our loyalties were. We'd made covenants. Mm-hmm. We had obligations that we felt we needed to fulfill. And so at a time when they could have really made a killing, they elected to forego their gold hunting activities and go to the valley. Mm. It must have been pretty difficult for some of them. I know if you read, for example, Henry Bigler's diary, gold fever really, really sets in.
Yeah.
And at that point, there's not a lot that has been done. You don't have the heavy mining that's going to go on in the subsequent years, and so the pickings are pretty nice.
Yeah,
and they are making pretty good income.
How did the gold rush impact the Latter-day Saint pioneer movement?
It was really a remarkable impact in two ways. One, from an economic standpoint, it was a windfall. Because the President of the United States, in his State of the Union address, confirms this gold rush. I mean, what more verification do you need? And that's printed in the Eastern Press. And so young men all over the United States have this vision of going out, picking up piles of gold, going home, life's good. And so you have this unbelievable number of people preparing to go west. The Mormons are doing their traveling as well. But now they're enveloped in this huge tide of humanity that is headed west to the California gold fields, many of them unprepared. Mm-hmm. And as they get out towards South Pass, many of them realize, hey, I'm not going to make it. Either I didn't provision correctly, my stock is fading, I've got to do something. And they're really – the only option they have is to – rather than take the regular route, which would take them up towards Fort Hall and then the old California Trail, they elect to go into the Salt Lake Valley to acquire new stock and to reprovision themselves. Well, they have all kinds of manufactured goods that the Saints needed. Mm-hmm. And they're discarding a lot of it because they're trying to lighten their loads. And so saints could actually go out and collect things that others are discarding, because saints aren't going anywhere. These people have another 700 miles or so beyond Salt Lake to travel to get to California. And they try to trade in their jaded stock for fresh stock. Well, the Mormons can take that stock and they can
replenish it.
Exactly. Yeah. And then turn around and sell it. And and so it, from that standpoint, it was a boon. But it also had the other aspect, and that is there, the idea that you were going to be isolated in the Salt Lake Valley with no disturbance, that vanished. Really, it became a national highway. In fact, so many immigrants came in that the saints were afraid they wouldn't even have winter forage for their own stock. And in some places, they actually created New England-style commons and had a herdsman to protect enough forage, because they had to keep it for their animals for the winter.
What did Brother Brigham feel about the gold rush?
It must have been a worry, because the proximity of the saints to the gold fields, I mean, they were a lot closer than those back east. I think George Q. Cannon mentioned that Brigham said not to go to the gold fields unless you were, quote, counseled so to do. And why would you be counseled to go to the gold fields? Well, actually, in the fall of 1849, Brigham sent a whole host of young men to California to assist Amos Lyman, who was administering the affairs of the church in California. Charles C. Rich was among that group. Henry Bigler, a young George Q. Cannon, a lot of young Latter-day Saints were in this group headed to California in the fall. They couldn't cross the Sierras, too late in the season. So they went south to Southern California and then up the coast and then across the San Joaquin and into the mines. And one of the reasons for them going was to help provide a safety net for residents of the Salt Lake Valley who were too old or too infirm to actually provide for themselves. And it was a real concern for Henry, because he was going to try to find gold to help sustain an elderly man in the valley, and he was so afraid that he wouldn't find enough to fulfill the obligation that he felt he had to do it. So in other words, if there was a charitable rationale behind the searching for gold, that would be a beneficial use in Brigham's eyes. But if you're just going for personal enrichment, that didn't fly.
And that is such an interesting contrast when you think of the motivation of the gold rush people of that day.
I think Brigham Young's most succinct statement about how he felt about the gold fields was made many years later. In I think it was 1857, someone had been speaking, and he got up and said, well, you know, that reminds me of something. He says, it reminds me of a man from Boston who came through many years ago on his way to the gold fields. He stopped a few days to hear me preach. After he heard me, came up to me and asked me on the street if I knew where hell was. I told him that I thought he was on the way to that very place. And if he crossed the Sierra Nevadas into the gold fields of California and discovered it was not hell, to come back and let me know. And since he has not returned, I presume he found it.
That's a great account. Mel, what's going on with the Mormon travelers on the trail that are coming to the Salt Lake Valley as well?
Right. In 49, the Mormon travelers have the luxury of waiting. They don't have to go as far as the Gold Rush people to get to California. They don't have to cross the Sierras. But for me, 1849 is when we learned that weather can really be a problem for your immigration. That is a year in which there's over 1,000 who traveling in Mormon companies. I believe 4 Mormon companies were in the Sweetwater area, and they were hit by early October. They learned in 1849 that you do not want to be caught in Wyoming in early October, as they are hit by a snowstorm there. And in fact, the snowstorm is so severe that it's about 3 feet deep, and they're stopped there for several days, can't move. In fact, the storm is so rough. We have an account here Bathsheba Smith is writing about the storm. She's traveling in her husband's company, George A. Smith's company. And she said, it was very grievous to hear the children cry, the ox low, the cow bawl, the sheep bleat, the pig squeal, the duck quack, the chickens cheep. And we couldn't tell them the cause why they had to suffer thus. The place where we camped had no wood but the roots of some willows where the emigrants had cut off the willows. So they're really having a difficult time in that storm. In fact, the cattle and everything, they just ran wild. They had to search for them the next couple of days to find them. And many of the cattle and the animals had died during the storm. It was that severe. So in 49, they learn what in 56 the Hancock people are going to discover also. So they get a little taste of that. There's also a rainstorm, a thunderstorm. This is what they learn about traveling on the plains, is that those thunderstorms can be very severe also. In fact, in this same company, Bathsheba Smith says that her husband, he was out guarding the cattle until 12 o'clock midnight, and it was a hailstorm. The hailstorm was so ferocious that she said that her husband was hit on the head with hailstones that were as large as walnuts with the hull on.
Oh, my goodness.
And then Lucy Maservey Smith described it as that the hails was as large as hen's eggs. And another fellow there picked up one that was as big as his fist. There were people who died during these storms. Not from the hail, but from lightning. We have the occasion where several died from being struck by lightning out on the plains. There's no trees. There's nothing there. You and your head are as a tall thing on the plains, and it attracts the lightning. And so some died from the effects of that.
What would we say is how many people are we moving into the Salt Lake Valley in those companies of 48 and 49? What would we say is are coming in, or either from California coming back or from the winter quarters area? What would we guesstimate would be the number of immigrants that are arriving during just those couple of years after the Vanguard Company?
Well, I've tried to count these numbers using figures that are given in the journals and reports. But just if we want ballpark figures, it's going to be thousands each year. And so we're adding to the population of Utah every year that we come.
Wow. And that's amazing. And so what are some of the other challenges? You've mentioned weather and then just the sheer size of the companies as challenges. What were some of the other unique challenges that these companies were facing during these years?
Should we talk about 1850? 1850, things change a little there. In 50, the Saints decide to go a different direction, to take a different route. You know, oftentimes our impression is that the Saints only traveled north of the Platte River. They stayed on the north side, and the non-Mormons were on the south side. But in 1850, thousands of our Saints traveled south on the south side of the Platte River. And they do that because they've seen that in that winter, it was a heavy, wet year, and they are fearing that the crossing of rivers could be a real problem for them. And also, because the gold rush has just occurred, and Indians were almost fair game for many of those gold rushers who shot at them as if they were targets, that the Mormons are concerned that if they go out on the plains in 50, there could be some retribution.
Yeah.
For them.
Because the Indians aren't going to make a distinction between.
They won't.
Yeah.
So there could be vengeance taken. So they decide, for safety's sake, too, to go south on the south side of the Platte, where there has been a new military road built. And so they go on what's called the Oxbow Trail in 1850 and go almost to Ash Hollow and to where they cross over to the north side again. But So it's a little bit different travel in 1850.
And the numbers were so large, I'm talking about non-Mormon travelers, that many of them are actually leaving as late as the Mormon trains. And in 49, and particularly in 50, the scourge of cholera stalks the trail. And you have actual accounts of Mormon trains trying to avoid other trains that are infected. They didn't really understand the dynamics of cholera, and it is a killer. Joseph Fish's father counted graves up to at least South Pass and had counted over 1,000. A lot of deaths.
How much did it affect the Mormon companies?
Some companies got ravaged in 50. But I think the social cohesion of Mormon companies may have, to some degree, insulated them, although it's a waterborne disease.
Yeah.
And you'd have wells dug down on the side of the Platte because it was boggy. You didn't want to go down to the Platte, so they would dig these wells. And then passing companies would go down these dirt, basically dirt steps down to these to the water, and it was a perfect conduit for disease. One company, a disease company, would infect the water, and then subsequent trains behind it dipping from the same well. So those that avoided that situation fared better.
What about the interaction between the non-Mormon companies and the Mormon companies? You, Mel, you mentioned that the non-Mormon gold rush companies were sometimes shooting at the Indians. Was there conflict between the various pioneers, the Latter-day Saints certainly having a different sense of mission than the Gentiles, if you will? Was there bad, good, or indifferent interaction between them?
I think in terms of interaction with non-Mormons, it seems to be rather friendly.
Right, on the trail. I think where the real interaction differences show up is when they get to Salt Lake.
Okay.
Yeah. It's when they get to the valley. Even before then, at the ferry points, if the ferry was being run, not just by Mormons, lots of ferries being run, but a lot of companies didn't want to pay the tolls. And also they become bottlenecks. Where you really have violence erupting on the trail is people trying to – I mean, they're in a race. They want to get to California ahead of everybody else, and so you have companies vying for position. And we have one letter in the church archives where a young man's in California or in Salt Lake describing 1,600 wagons backed up at a single ferry point waiting to get across. And so tempers got really short at that time, not to mention the fact that you've got limited supplies, limited provisions, all the other issues related to trying to get across the continent play into it.
Well, it's been fascinating today is on Past Impressions on the Mormon Channel to talk about those 1848, 49, 50 pioneer companies. And we'll continue our discussion with Michael Landon and Mel Bayshore. Thank you for this program, and we look forward to having you again in the future. We hope that you will join us on Past Impressions on the Mormon Channel for our future episodes as we talk about the people, places, events, and key issues associated with the history of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints.